The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. HBO's new series Westworld is based on a 1973 movie written and directed by the novelist Michael Crichton. Both versions are set in a futuristic Western-themed amusement park where very wealthy adults indulge their fantasies on the startlingly human-like, responsive robot hosts which populate the park. No surprise, things take a bad turn.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
Have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
No.
You and everyone you know were built to gratify the desires of the people who pay to visit your world. What if I told you that you can't hurt the newcomers?
Don't you touch her!
And that they can do anything they want to you.
That's just a little clip from Westworld. The show's slick design and visuals get high praise from audiences and critics and beg the question, in the age of 3D printing and advanced artificial intelligence, are the cutting-edge host robots from Westworld just around the bend? Lux Alpdrom is a writer, consultant, and sex educator who looked into that very question for Motherboard. And Lux, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to chat robots.
We're going to do our best to avoid spoilers. But how about just starting with a little bit of a description of the Westworld hosts? You know, how lifelike are they?
So the Westworld hosts are extremely lifelike. I mean, not surprisingly, they're played by human actors, so they look like human beings. But even beyond that superficial resemblance to real people, they're able to bleed, they're able to eat, they respond to injury in the same way that we would. Like, there have been episodes where you see a host get beat up and be bruised and then heal. They also are able to convincingly have a conversation like a human. What's interesting with Westworld is that they talk a lot about these hosts being part of pre-programmed storylines and they're following paths, but within that world, any guest can come in and completely derail a storyline. I might go in and decide I'm going to kill off a character, and the hosts then have to adapt.
So they respond, they bleed when cut, they appear to emote, they adapt. Any of these aspects close to our current ability to produce human-like androids?
Unfortunately, not so close. Or fortunately,
depending on
your
ask.
Perspective. It's funny, I went into this and I was like, well, we're probably fairly close on some of it. And my initial thought when I started researching this was, well, probably the body exterior stuff, that's probably a little bit further away. But the AI stuff, we're probably pretty close on that. And while we're not really close on any of it, it's actually the reverse. We are closer on the exterior and kind of the simulation of a human body than we are on the simulation of a human mind.
Yeah, so you spoke to somebody who is actually working on growing skin.
Yes, yeah, so I spoke to this fantastic artist, Amy Carl. She has this art project, Regenerative Reliquary, where she has a bioprinted scaffold that's in the shape of a hand, and she embedded stem cells in it. And the idea of that project is over the course of 2 years, those stem cells will eventually grow into all of the different types of cells that are in a human hand. So that's actually really, really cool. And she told me a lot about science that's being done and research that's being done on growing skin. And that's something that she personally is familiar with because in addition to the artwork that she's done, she also just personally has had a lot of skin grafts over her life.
Well.
And what she told me was that skin grafts and growing skin, actually not that hard. We're pretty good at artificially creating skin from collagen, at just growing skin, potentially growing artificial skin that is a blend of synthetic fibers and organic fibers. But the problem is that, you know, you can grow a huge sheet of skin, but if you just kind of put it on a metal frame, it's going to die. because in order to keep skin and any other human cell alive, you need a whole system that's going to pump blood and nutrients into it and keep the cells regenerating. Like, building them once, that's one thing, and if you're then grafting it onto an existing human body, it's going to become a part of this existing system. But creating that system from scratch is actually fairly complicated. And when you start to think about the level of complexity that we see on Westworld, where it's not just, again, skin on a metal frame, but, you know, skin with a whole system of blood so that these robots can bleed, so that they, again, can get injured in a convincingly human fashion and bruise and get black eyes. And then they're able to eat and they're able to do all of these things. Presumably, they still have similar lubrication systems to us. Like, their eyes are going to be lubricating the way human eyes are. I'm sure they have to produce some kind of saliva. And while it might be possible to do a kind of bio and technology hybrid to create that, probably what you're going to see, what it seems like in the show, is that really it's more they've just recreated a human body and then grafted it onto a metal frame, which is really, really challenging. And, you know, there's certain systems you can absolutely leave out, but it's like a tapestry. If you start pulling at the different threads, you might have unexpected fallout. And to get a whole integrated system that's working and convincingly looks like a biological life form requires a level of information and understanding of the human body that we don't have yet.
How about the artificial intelligence component? Are we anywhere close to seeing robots that can think for themselves, build upon that knowledge, and even develop unique personalities?
So again, as I said, I thought when I was going into this that that would be the part that we would be closest to. Because when you think about it, it seems like, oh, well, you know, I can talk to Siri and there's Alexa. And obviously, if we have all these robotic assistants, getting the technology or getting this technology that just living in a box, not in a human body, that seems relatively easy. But that's actually like a common fallacy that you see in AI. The researcher I spoke with, Kate Compton, told me about AI summers and AI winters. And we're currently, according to her, in about the fourth AI summer. In an AI summer, everything seems really, really promising. There's all this investment capital going into AI. Everyone's really excited. They're convinced we're about to overcome all these challenges. And then eventually they hit a roadblock and the funding dries up and you go into an AI winter. So this has happened multiple times. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks is what she referred to as a strong AI problem. And the way she explained that to me was that if I go to a grocery store and I see someone I know, that seems like a pretty simple interaction. Like, oh, I'm just going to say hi to them. And it seems like, on the surface, that's not hard. I just program a robot to say hi to someone in the grocery store. But when you start to think about it a little deeper, there's so many different layers. Am I angry at this person? Is this someone I know well? Is this someone I don't know that well? Is this someone I haven't seen in a few months? Is this someone I see every day? Is this someone who owes me a favor? There's so many different levels of social interaction. And integrating that complexity into an artificial intelligence is really, really challenging. There's all sorts of nuance. Maybe I see that person in the grocery store and I can tell from their face that they're having a bad day and they don't want to talk to me. Like, how do you program that kind of nuanced understanding of human interaction?
Lux Alpdrom is with us. She's a writer and a consultant, and she's also a sex educator who, inspired in part by Westworld, the HBO series, started looking into how far along we are into creating very human-like androids, which populate the series. Well, that, I guess, is why it's fiction. You know, there's no underlying system yet for creating and feeding skin. There's no ability to interpret or exhibit nuanced social cues. But how about that idea of the funding, the AI winter, that seeing robots like this, seeing even in fiction, inspires us and pushes us forward and maybe even pushes science and funding towards discovering and creating something like these robots?
So I think there's definitely a history of science fiction inspiring science fact. Like if you look at the technology that was in Star Trek, for instance, versus the technology that we have now, there's obviously some influence there. Like there's the communicators in the early Star Trek definitely were very similar to modern cell phones. Or there's just a lot of times where people see it and they want to make it real and they pursue it. We still don't have hoverboards that are really hoverboards, but you have people trying to get hoverboards. And I definitely think to some extent we will see a West potential for a Westworld effect, but maybe not in quite as direct a way as we've seen with other forms of technology. Because I think one thing that really needs to be considered when we talk about super realistic, super lifelike robots is, why do we want them? And I've had a lot of conversations about this over the years. There was a book a few years ago by Dr. David Levy called Love and Sex with Robots that was just really taking for granted this idea that in a few decades, we'll be having romantic relationships with robots. And I found that very strange, and I find a lot of this assumption that absolutely we're going to have really human-like robots as a guarantee very, very strange, because as we've noted, it takes a lot of money to fund the research on all of this stuff, and you kind of have to have a consumer demand for what's very likely going to be a very expensive product. And when you start to piece together like the path we would have to go down to achieve this end goal, to me it starts to seem not particularly feasible. Now that doesn't mean that we're not going to see some scientific advances that are inspired by Westworld that are really awesome and really important. I mean, one of the things that came up in my conversation with Amy Carl is that the technology that would be needed to create an organic exterior is also technology that could be applied to, say, regenerating a finger. If you lose part of a finger, maybe we could grow you a new one. Or if you have some other kind of injury, maybe we can help you heal faster. And I think research towards a Westworld type robot could certainly come in handy for those kinds of things. And I think those applications would be far more useful than just creating more human-like creatures when we already have a lot of humans.
So if it were possible and you had a whole lot of money, is Westworld a place that you would like to visit?
So I'm torn on that. I mean, there's part of me that is very, very curious about what it would be like. And part of the thesis of the show is that being in this world where there are no consequences to your actions teaches you who you really are. And there is a part of me that's like, ooh, would I go to this theme park and would I kill people and would I do terrible things because they're not really people? But there's also part of me that's not even interested in that exploration, and it's not necessarily convinced that the really grim view of humanity that Westworld posits is actually true. I mean, I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, people love violent video games and people love this and people love that. But I think we do have this barrier where if something is truly human-like, even if we know it's not human, we're probably not going to get that much joy out of causing it pain and causing it suffering. When you look at kind of the history of war, people have to really dehumanize and really detach from their enemies before they're actually able to just... There's a reason why we're switching to drone warfare, because it's much easier to get people to pull the trigger when they don't have to see the face or don't have to deal with their enemies' humanity. So this idea that we're going to make really, really lifelike robots and rich people are going to go kill them for their vacation, I think it's an interesting fantasy. It's an interesting topic to explore, but maybe I'm a little too optimistic about humanity to think that most of us actually would find that it's not what we want to do with our vacation time.
Lux Alptrom, writer and sex educator, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You'll find a link to read her article for Motherboard, How Long Before We Can Build Westworld Host Robots for Real. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The information age means everything is just a Google search away. News, services, tools, products, instructions, communities, and of course, media. The age of streaming gives us instant access to millions of songs and movies and TV shows, squeezing out video store chains, tiny art house cinemas, and traditional television channels, which once seeded and nurtured generations of classic film buffs. So where to find movies not on Netflix, Amazon, or Hulu? Like the classic Godfather series from the 1970s.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop. We'll get there.
Now listen, whoever comes to you with this Barzini meeting, he's a traitor. Don't forget that.
Todd VanderWerf is critic at large for Vox, who worries that classic movies, like this one, and the avid film buffs who love them may be one casualty of leaving physical media behind. Todd, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here.
The Godfather series, Casablanca, Citizen Kane, none of them on streaming services, but you can pay to rent them digitally. So your concern is not that they can't be found, but that people won't know what to look for?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird and complicated paradox to unpack, but it's one that, as I've talked to a lot of film scholars and a lot of film critics, they have expressed to me that this younger generation that's coming up certainly knows about, like, the recent movies or movies sort of from the last 10 years, but, like, you get beyond that and it's a little hazier, which was, you know, not true when I was coming up, which was not that long ago, or, you know, when they were coming up. So kind of the problem is, and the way I sort of express the paradox is, once you're already a classic film fan, there has never been a better time to be a classic film fan. You can get pretty much anything you want. You can get it digitally. You can buy it. You can rent it. You just can't stream it. But the problem is that because streaming is how a lot of younger consumers are getting their media nowadays, that means that when they go to Netflix or something, they are not necessarily seeing these classic films. And I always sort of talk about it in terms of, a lot of people remember, like, the video store. You'd go there and they'd have a classic section. It was often pretty meager. You know, if you went to a Blockbuster, it might have like 20 titles. But they were there, and, like, you could go and look at them, and, like, you get sort of a sense of, like, what the history was. And you don't really have anything analogous on Netflix or Hulu or something like Amazon.
So the surprise player in this story, Turner Classic Movies. This is a cable network that many people might associate with, you know, really old media and probably with old people. So who's watching TCM?
TCM doesn't have complete demographics because they're not Nielsen rated. They don't have commercials, so they don't need to get Nielsen ratings. But from surveys they've done, they actually have a younger audience than you might expect. Certainly it skews older than other channels, but they do have quite a few young people who watch, who are either sort of into the retro vintage look of it all, or are, you know, people who are serious film fans and interested in that. Now, certainly the network's audience is older than a lot of other networks, but I think to some degree that's to be expected. TCM is sort of looking at combating this sort of issue of, you know, our audience is old, the younger viewers aren't necessarily coming in. They've started their own streaming service, which is called Filmstruck. It's actually out right now. And they're doing that with the Criterion Collection, which is another really strong collector of old films, great films. And I've been playing around with it. I just love it. Right now, right as when I was last on there, they have a really nice collection of the films of Akira Kurosawa. He's the great Japanese director. They have nearly everything he's directed. I think the one they're missing is Ron, who's a King Lear remake. But they also have, you know, they have a really great musical called The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The things they don't have, which are kind of staying on the TCM channel, are some of the older screwball comedies, some of the older westerns, and some of the older musicals. And that is going to be, I won't lie, that's going to be an impediment for some people. But I'm hopeful that as Filmstruck gains subscribers and gains attention, that they'll, you know, sort of start to shift some of that from the TV channel to the service.
So Filmstruck offers classic films curated for an individual user, but still a user's got to get there. How is this different than getting people to hop off of Netflix and look someplace else?
You know, I think that the buy-in that they're hoping for is some of these titles were on Hulu. They were kind of hidden away. They were not in a great place. I think the buy-in they're kind of hoping for is, as we move toward, and this is going into a different region of the business entirely, but as we move toward a future where most everything is on streaming, these smaller streaming services are going to kind of get lumped in with the larger ones and bundles and packages. And I think they're sort of hoping to become the classic film streaming service. So right now, does it solve the problem immediately right now, November 2016? No. But, you know, November 2018, I think it may have really started to bear fruit.
Todd VanderWerf, critic at large for Vox, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find a link to read Todd's article, The Age of Streaming is Killing Classic Film. Can Turner Classic Movies be its salvation? The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Colson Whitehead with the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
This week, Colson Whitehead won the National Book Award for his novel, The Underground Railroad. In his acceptance speech, he advised, "Be kind to everybody, make art, and fight the power." We got some creative advice from him for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. We asked him, which is easier to write, the first sentence or the last?
Not harder, but the first sentence, you know, before I start, you know, writing seriously, I am toying with this or that opening gambit, and so that I think about that a lot. With Sag Harbor and Zone One, my two previous novels, I had the last sentence the first day I thought of the book, and so I was writing towards that final sentence for the whole time I was conceiving of it and writing it. So it varies.
So how much plotting or planning do you do before writing? I mean, does your original idea and characters, do they go through a lot of evolutions, or are you pretty well set?
I do a lot of outlining before I start. I have to know the beginning and the end. The middle can be fuzzy, but I have to know what the destination is before I set out. The middle can be fuzzy and changes definitely as characters become more or less important. The plot changes. You have to allow for that, you know, the magic of the process. And then it just seems like if it's hard enough to find the right words each day, if you don't actually know what you're going to do each day, it seems twice as hard. So each day I have an assignment, you know, describe the sheriff, introduce the deputy, and, you know, that's 1 to 4 pages of stuff I can work with that day.
So do you work on a schedule, like I'm writing 1 to 4 pages today?
Sometimes it's a one-page day. Sometimes I have like a dentist thing at 1, and I'm like, the whole day's shot. So if I can do 8 pages a week, that seems like a nice amount. And it can be Monday and Tuesday, and then Sunday, or it can be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. But as long as I'm accumulating, it, you know, it takes a dent out of the huge mountain that is a novel.
So what does your writing environment look like? Do you tend to write in one place?
I work at home, you know, so make some coffee around 10, work. I can check my email, put on CNN, make a sandwich, take a nap, weep, depending. So all those kind of breaks are fine. But, you know, 10 to 3 is like a productive day for me.
What's your personal worst distraction from getting your work done?
Well, for me, it's you know, more teaching and obligations. Once I start a book, I'm pretty psyched to work on it, and I don't have a trouble getting myself to the table. I may be stuck for a week or a month or something like that, but I'm always pretty eager to work. So it's more travel or teaching or things that really keep me from concentrating in the way I like to concentrate, which is pretty intensely.
So when do you know when to walk away or abandon an idea or even a page?
Well, in terms of ideas, you know, when I'm in between things and have two ideas, like should I work on this or that, whichever one I just start thinking about more is the one I tend to stick with. That's sort of an obvious. In terms of, you know, finishing a book, you know, I've spent so much at that point, you know, the last 10 pages, everything has happened. I've been working towards this conclusion for a long time, so I know. So basically when everything that had to happen has happened. And then in terms of showing it to people, when there was that cliche of like, put the comma in, take it out, and you can't decide. So when I can't figure out really tiny, obvious grammatical things, I know it's time to show somebody.
What do you think is the worst mistake that new writers make?
Not listening to the teacher? I don't know. I mean, I think teaching made me a much better editor, and so I definitely have a lot of pet peeves that I cut out when I read a story by a freshman, and it's the first workshop. And people are always smiling, or they're rolling their eyes, like, he rolled her eyes, you know, his eyes, she rolled her eyes, and like, so I have like various rules of like, no smiling, no shrugging, no rolling your eyes, all these sort of little props, which, you know, maybe you can learn to do it in a different kind of action or in dialogue. So I think it's good for them, and editing them has made me a much better editor of my own work. So,
what's the best piece of advice you ever got about writing?
I don't know if I ever got any good advice about writing. I think I learned, you know, stick with it. There's going to be a lot of disappointments, and it's just a hard business. You're going to write a bad story, write a better story, and then relapse and write a bad story again. So just keep reading and writing and trying to figure out what you're doing wrong and how you can make it better next time.
You've said before that after you write a book, you do such a deep dive when you're writing that you kind of want to get away from the topic afterwards. So are there any topics that you just think, I can never write about that because I want it to be part of my life?
Well, I think, you know, the Intuitionist is takes off from a crime novel structure, and a book I'm working on now or thinking of working on is a crime novel. So maybe having a buffer of 18 years allows me to go back to the subject. So we'll see.
Is there a desert island book for you?
Practically it would be long, right? So The Odyssey or Gravity's Rainbow, something really dense and something that invites rereading. So maybe Gravity's Rainbow.
Do you have a fantasy job other than writer?
Sometimes I think it'd be cool to write advertisements and just boil things down to a 10-word catchphrase or a 2-word catchphrase. So I'm not going to do it, obviously, but my friend's uncle came up with plop, plop, fizz, fizz, which seems so genius. So if you could just be that kind of master ad guy, thinking up stuff like that sticks in the culture, that'd be kind of a cool job.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Colson Whitehead there, newly minted winner of the National Book Award. We spoke to him for NHPR's 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast. You can listen to a much longer interview with Colson Whitehead and novelist Ben Winters at wordofmouthradio.org. And from celebrated writer to celebrity chef, Mario Batali, he of the Orange Crocs, is joining us for Writers on a New England Stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth this Sunday. There are still tickets for you to join the conversation with the restaurateur, the food lover, and Food Network star. He'll be talking about his new Big American Cookbook. So bring your questions, bring your appetite, and join us. Information at the NHPR or the Music Hall website. Thanks to Jason Leonard and Blue Dot Sessions for music today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.